Frank's Red Hot is the perfect blend of flavor and heat, so you can use an entire bottle to make recipes like buffalo chicken dip or buffalo nachos, or even things that don't start with buffalo. Frank's Red Hot. I put that shit on everything.
Queens and Mason Avenue's Minor League Podcast. I am Steve Seipel, and I'm joined this week by Lucas Vlahos and Thomas Henderson. How are you guys doing?
Good. Yourself? Good. Hello.
All right. So, promote extend trade this week, and I was kind of looking on Wikipedia to find something either Star Wars related or video game related, but like just nothing good happened on today's date with either one of those things, so I had to fall back on the regular one that I had planned. But on this date back in 1988, at the NBA slam dunk contest, Michael Jordan made that signature slam dunk from the three-point line that expired the Air Jordan logo. And it became one of like the most iconic images in basketball history. So, what iconic images of Mets baseball history are we going to promote, extend, or trade? First up, we have Andy's catch in front of the AIG sign in 2006. Next, we have Jesse Orozco throwing his glove up in the air and falling to his knees in 1986. World Series. And then last but not least is the flag unfurled over the grass at Shea Stadium on the September 21st, 2001 game.
Man, this sucks because I've said this a lot of times, probably on this pod and definitely in the Slack or wherever else. If the Mets win that game, Andy's catch is remembered, I think, in the same breath as the Willie Mays over the shoulder catch.
Absolutely.
Like, it's that good a catch in that.
There's a statue of Andy outside City Field.
Yes, making that catch. Like, that is, moment aside, that is one of the best catches you'll ever see, and it's in game 7 of an NLCS. And then they lost the game, so.
Typical Mets.
Like, also, I remember, like, doing laps around my house after, like, jumping off the sofa where I was watching with my dad and doing laps around the house.
There are so many different, like, aspects of that catch. A, he just jumped. I mean, it was literally at, like, the peak of his jump. Mm-hmm. And the ball was caught, you know, it was just barely snow-coned.
Mm-hmm.
He slammed into the wall, so you know that, you know, there was the chance that the force could have popped it out of his glove, which thankfully he didn't. And then he doubled up, who was it, Scott Rolen?
No, Jim Edmonds at first base. Jim Edmonds was the one who hit the ball. Right?
Yeah.
That's, I tweeted when Scott Rolen, deserving Hall of Famer, by the way, I have no grudges against Scott Rolen. Favorite Scott Rolen moment, Andy robbing him. I mean, I can do like both the Joe Buck call on the from TV and the Gary Cohen radio call from memory, word for word, as I've watched the highlights so many damn times. But they lost the game.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of for 86, I kind of think of Mookie crossing the plate more than Orozco glove in the air. That's where I thought the last one was going.
Is it weird to think that the most iconic visual from that is actually the ball just trickling through? It's Buckner. Not even of a Met. Oh, yeah. It's Buckner.
Yeah, it's Buckner. But I think of like Knight scoring, I mean, and like everyone hugging him at home.
Yep.
And yeah, like that's the iconic thing I think of when I think of
one, that one play. There are different, not angles. I guess different angles, but of the same exact thing going on. But yeah, there are so many. I mean, you have
different
Mookie.
Angles, both literally and figuratively.
Yeah.
I mean,
you have
crazy.
Buckner just kind of standing there, and whoops, you have Mookie just running. You have Knight just raising his arms in celebration, like, holy shit, that just happened. And then obviously in the next game when they actually won.
This is definitely my age and my personal Mets experience, but it's the Endy catch for me.
Yeah,
like,
that's fair.
I wasn't even alive in 1986. I wasn't old enough to really appreciate
you weren't old enough to appreciate 9/11.
No, see, I have very distinct memories of 9/11, but I don't actually remember watching this Met game. I don't know that I did at the time.
I remember the Piazza home run, but I don't remember much else about the game.
I don't even remember the Piazza. I may not have even watched the game. I don't know. Despite having very distinct memories of 9/11, but not specifically this game. So for me, it's the Endy catch. And if you're an older listener and you disagree with me, I can't argue with you. I'm sure I'd feel differently if I'd seen the 1986 World Series in person.
I'm pretty sure I've said this story before, but I remember the whole game, you know, against the Braves after 9/11, that game. And I was out with my family when we went out to eat. And so I was kind of like monitoring the game as we're eating. And we left about like the sixth inning, whatever it was. And the Mets were losing at that point. And for like the next couple of years, I didn't realize that the Mets came back and won that game. And I was under the assumption that the Mets lost.
That's so funny.
Usually a good assumption with the Mets.
Yeah. I mean, it was only until probably, I guess, SNY came about and they started having more like older, you know, retelevised Mets moments and games and things like that, that I realized that, like, wait a minute, like, oh, they came back and won in like the eighth inning. Okay. Freaking Mets.
I will forever hate Yadier Molina because of this. I will never support, I know objectively Yadier Molina is a Hall of Fame player, but I will never support his Hall of Fame.
It's gonna make me so mad.
I just refuse. I will not do it.
Mm-hmm.
I will especially grasp at any straws.
He could not hit for shit then. Like, he turned into a better hitter as he got older. But back then, he was not a good hitter at all. Like, if someone else did it to you, you can't, sometimes you just got to be like, yeah, well,
Scott Rowland's a Hall of Famer. Had homered, it would have been like, yeah, well, Scott Rowland.
I mean, Scott Rowland's Hall. But like, I remember at the time being like, really, Yadier Molina's going to do that? Like, of all the people? Because he couldn't hit then. Like, he was never an amazing hitter, but he ended up being above average in his later years.
Who do you hate more, Yadier Molina or Adam Wainwright?
Molina.
Yeah, because the Wainwright thing, it just doesn't matter if Molina doesn't hit the home run.
Yep.
Mm.
Also, anyone who gives Beltran shit for not swinging the bat, shut the fuck up.
You've never seen a curveball before.
You do not know what you're talking about.
Yep. I wonder what the WPA for that pitch was. I've never actually gone back and looked, but
if they do it for that long ago, it's probably insane.
I'd guess 30% at least on that one, because the Mets had the bases loaded.
Yeah, no,
and we're only down one, so a single wins the game.
Ugh, depressing.
It was two outs. Maybe it's lower than that, but it's got to be pretty high.
And does that matter for context, WPA? Do they factor in, like...
Yeah, it's leverage. Or it's
talking about, like, game-wise, too. Do they factor in that it's Game 7 of the NLCS?
Oh, so you're saying not just game WPA, but, like, World Series WPA.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, that's, like, of the playoffs, that's probably a huge WPA swing. Yep. Because... Like, the Tigers weren't good.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when the Mets got... When the series started in against the Cardinals in the first place... what the hell is... middle school friend whose name is escaping me. Paul Sondy. That's it. We're, like, jumping around our lockers because we were so convinced the Mets were winning the World Series. We're like, the Cardinals are terrible and... or not mediocre, and the Tigers aren't good. We got this. And then...
It's crazy. The Mets were clearly the best team left.
Yeah, unfortunately, that did not work out. Just going back to see who was on the Tigers, because I remember, I know, like...
Miggy and fuck all.
Yeah, it was just a bunch of people.
No, they weren't on the Tigers yet, were they?
Miggy that was the next...
No, that was the next offseason they got traded, him and Dontrell. All right, here's the starting lineup for the 2006 Tigers.
catching. Brandon Inge, is he on the Tigers at this
point? Yes, he was.
There we go.
So catching, starting catcher is Ivan Rodriguez.
Okay.
First baseman, Chris Shelton.
Who?
He had an OPS of 806, not bad, but again, it was 2006, so. He had an 806 OPS plus. I mean, excuse me, an 806 OPS.
Oh, God.
And then,
Jesus.
806 and OPS. God, holy
and
shit.
And then a 106 OPS plus.
Yeah.
That's right. Put in context of 2006.
Thoroughly mediocre first baseman, okay.
Yeah. Second baseman, Placido Polanco.
I remember Placido Polanco.
Shortstop, Carlos Guillen. Third baseman, Brandon Inge.
Yeah.
Left fielder, Craig Monroe.
I'm
remembering some guys here.
Craig Monroe.
The infield I mostly remembered, and then you...
Craig Monroe led the team in home runs with 28. And yet he had a 99 OPS plus.
Okay. Whatever you say.
Yep. Center fielder, Curtis Grandison. Right fielder, Maglio Ordóñez. And
I remember Maglio Ordóñez. Okay.
DH, Marcus Thames. And on the bench, they had... On the bench, they had Omar Infante, Sean Casey, Dimitri Young. And then their starting lineup. Wow. All right. So, I mean, nothing really changes, I guess. Their best pitcher was Justin Verlander, which was
Mets
the case
legend.
Which was the case for literally like two decades. There was Jeremy Bonderman.
Okay. I remember Nate, that name.
Nate Robinson.
Okay.
Robertson, excuse me. Fucking 40-year-old Kenny Rogers. Justin Verlander. And Zach Minor.
Zach Minor. That rings a few bells. Not a ton, but sure.
Closer Todd Jones.
Nope.
And nope. I don't remember him.
Setup men Joel Zumaya and Fernando Rodney.
Oh, pre-Guitar Hero accident.
Yeah, Guitar Hero.
I believe this was Guitar Hero accident year.
Oh, it was?
Yeah.
Was he like back for the playoffs? Because I remember that timeline's a little fuzzy for me.
Don't recall. And then they had rookie Andrew Miller through 10 innings.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, this would have been before the Was Cameron Maben around at all?
He did not have any at-bats for them. But, yeah, he was around.
Speaking of remembering some 2006 guys, Michael Mayer just tweeted that Carlos Beltran is joining the Mets front office, according to the New York Post. So,
all right.
He returns.
What is he going to do?
Sure, why not?
Yeah, why not?
I have no clue. But speaking of 2006 Mets vibes.
Yep. All right, so we have some unfortunate news to discuss this week. So do we want to start with the depressing news or the really depressing news? You guys' choice.
Really depressing.
We're going to go with the really depressing?
Yes.
It gets better. It builds.
Here's the really depressing news. All right. So it was reported that this past Wednesday that Kerry Wynne Hill, who was in a relationship with outfielder Khalil Lee in 2001, well, she's filing a lawsuit against him. And according to her account, the two were considering rekindling their relationship last year in May. And they met up, but things turned sour and the two started arguing. And one thing led to another. And Khalil Lee kicked her, he slapped her, he pulled her hair, and that caused her to fall, and then he choked her. On a couple of months later, on October 11th now, the Syracuse Police Department, they issued a warrant for criminal obstruction of breathing or blood circulation, which is a Class A misdemeanor that carries a penalty of a maximum of 1 year in jail. So I looked it up what that actually means. And Article 121, Section 11 of the New York State Penal Code defines criminal obstruction of breathing as, quote, with the intent to impede the normal breathing, he or she applies pressure on the throat or neck of such person or B, blocks the nose or mouth of such person. So he was choking her.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. based on the, you know, circumstances that the woman, her account and the and her evidence and whatnot, you know, it certainly sounds like he was fulfilling all the criteria, you know, and applying pressure to her throat or neck. So, Khalil Lee, what the fuck?
See you later.
Yeah. One thing that's kind of weird that I'm not really fully getting here is that now this is just coming out, and Major League Baseball is announcing that they're investigating the incident now as per their domestic violence policies. This took place like 6 months ago, May 2022.
That happened with Mike Clevenger too, I'm pretty sure.
Say it again, I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
That happened with Mike Clevenger too, I'm pretty sure. It's because I think it has to do with, I'm not 100% sure, I think it has to do with when the league is allowed to, because it's like a criminal proceeding before this or something like that. Like, I remember the Mike Clevenger thing, like, it happened before the White Sox signed him. And the White Sox signed him and they said they didn't know about it because Major League Baseball wasn't informed yet. And then here we are, you know?
Sounds like something they should be informed on.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I'm not going to.
But I don't know how this stuff works like that. Like, yeah. for the legal aspect of it, I don't know. I have no idea. But that's what I thought. I remember seeing that with Clevenger, that it happened before the White Sox signed him.
I'm not going to kill the Mets without for that, at least, without knowing the details of when they knew. Like, if it turns out they knew earlier and did nothing, well, then yeah, fuck that. But
yeah, because he got called up after this.
Yeah.
Right. Like. Yep. If the timelines match up, like,
I don't believe he played, but I'm pretty sure, yeah, he got called up and just kind of was on the bench for a week or so, whatever it was, in like June. Let's look it up.
He got a hit against the Marlins, didn't he? And struck out a million times?
Yeah.
Or am I misremembering that? He like had a game-winning hit against the Marlins or something and went one for like 18 with 16 strikeouts or something crazy.
He appeared in two games.
Oh, then I'm overstating. Yeah,
you're thinking of last year.
I am thinking of that. Okay. Yeah, okay.
He played in like 10 games last year and struck out like 20 times in 10 games. He hit a home run this year. I mean, his batting line for the 2022 season.
Oh, I remember this. Okay.
500, 502. Not bad.
I remember.
Yeah.
I remember that.
But yeah, not, you know, I mean, he's a kind of marginal player to begin with, and now having this kind of baggage attached to him, regardless of, you know, what the investigation finds, I can't really imagine him having that much of a future left in baseball. Unless the woman comes out and has a formal media, you know, session and says that she was lying and trying to extort him and whatever, and there's no evidence and she made everything up and it's photoshopped and whatever, which is extremely unlikely.
Yeah, that should never happen.
Yeah. I don't think that Khalil Lee is much of a future left in baseball here.
Yep. I won't even I don't think there's much more to discuss. His talent is irrelevant. Right. His performance to this point is irrelevant. If this is the kind of person you are, like, you do not need to be playing baseball. That's kind of it.
The weirdest thing is, I mean, I don't know if this is something we need to like start doing now. Like, maybe we'll add this to the bottom of our daily prospect reports and everything. But if you go to, you know, the Syracuse Police Department website right now and you go to their open warrant section, boom, right there, Khalil R. Lee, black male, age 25, of 642 North Salina Street. It's all right there. Like, it's not something that everybody is looking for, but it's just so weird that it's been literally sitting there out in the open since October. I mean,
the unfortunate reality is that we shouldn't be the ones doing this.
Exactly.
Right.
No. the Mets should, or baseball should.
And it seems like they saw it, and we don't. Who knows if they're going to do something or if they're in the process of doing something. I don't know what legal workings there are behind the scenes here, but you know.
Yep. Well, on that
note.
On that depressing trail off note, let's get to our second piece of unfortunate news now. And it was reported on Saturday by Will Salmon of The Athletic that Matthew Allen, our old friend Matthew Allen, he underwent UCL revision surgery sometime in January. And UCL revision surgery is exactly what it sounds like. It's a revision to the initial UCL procedure. Basically, it's a second Tommy John surgery. The recovery time, basically the same as regular Tommy John. So if Matthew Allen does come back, it's going to be sometime during like the 2024 season, best case scenario. And we already knew that.
Yeah, January, right?
Yeah. We already knew that he already had one, you know, setback from Tommy John surgery. So who knows if that happens again with the second revision. But all that is, you know, a big if, because, you know, let's be honest here. This very well could be the end of Matthew Allen's professional career.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know that that's an indictment. I don't, for me at least, that's not an indictment of the draft process that they employed to acquire him in the first place. It's just sort of unfortunate reality of pitchers, and it sucks for him. It sucks for the team. It sucks all around.
Yeah, I mean, the Mets, if they have interest in continuing to roster him, when he's healthy, he'll be like 24. And that's also best case scenario. It'll be over 4 years since the last time he pitched. You know, at some point, I believe, in 2025, he'll be a minor league free agent, so who even knows?
Do they have to add him to the 40 this offseason?
Yeah, to protect him from the rule.
Yeah, I mean, that's the big
someone
obstacle.
Will rule. I think someone would rule 5 him.
100%.
And stash him. And yep. Just put him on IL and just be like, okay.
Figure that aside, it, see if you're healthy. That aside, though, who knows if he even wants to pitch anymore?
Yeah.
Because, you know, sure. Sure. In the span of a couple of years, you know, it's 3 major surgeries on his elbow now. You know, at a certain point, he might say, listen, you know, like how Sandy Koufax retired because he wanted to be able to have a functional arm. At a certain point, Matthew Allen might just be like, listen, I like pitching and everything, but I want to be able to have an elbow that moves.
I mean, I think
I can see
fair.
That going either way. Yeah.
Yeah.
But like Lucas, I agree. It's not an indictment of the draft process that they went through, but also this is the risk if you're going to do something like that, where the downside is the guy gets hurt and you get nothing out of an entire year, which the other side of it is he doesn't get hurt and we're talking about adding Matthew Allen to this rotation. You know what I mean? Like it's a risk reward situation, and the Mets needed to be risky at the time because they had such few high profile prospects in the system and they got Beatty out of it, but. And that's great, but everything else has been a wash so far.
Yeah, I mean, so far and probably forever. You know, you have Brett Beatty. He's the only guy in that draft, really, that has any type of ceiling to contribute. I mean, of the 40 guys that they drafted, 31 signed. So we're already missing 9 guys at this point. Josh Wolf, their second-round pick, they traded him to Cleveland.
I would say that was useful.
yeah. No, not taking anything away from that. But obviously he's not going to contribute to the Mets. Their fourth round pick, Jake Mangum, he was traded to the Marlins. And so now everybody from fifth round pick onto the 40th round pick that signed, they're either low upside guys or they've already been released.
Yep.
I think the most likely guy to have any kind of major league impact is Zach Ashford, maybe, if he gets promoted in a major emergency situation as like a fifth outfielder at some point.
Mm-hmm.
It really is the damnedest thing. They don't even, I was looking, they literally do not even have like a pop-up middle reliever that you need to call.
No, they get no one.
It's, yeah, literally is nobody left in that draft.
And, like, the vast majority of us, and probably me included, if Beatty is good, I won't care. But also...
Yeah, no, it is what it is, but...
But also, like, you can't do that. Like, that's how you end up in the situations where we've been talking... That's how you end up with the system the way we've had to discuss right. The Mets system.
Now, take this 2019 draft now that literally it is all coming down to one guy, Rhett Beatty. Regardless of how he does, you know, in the next couple of years. But you have literally just one player. Combine that with the 2020 draft, where at this point you're not getting anything. Eric Orsi is the only guy standing left. Everyone else has been traded or released from that draft.
That's only five players, but yeah. Or
six. Right, right. But still, you're not getting any value from that draft besides Orsi. And then combine that with, you know, 2018 and the years prior, where they're kind of doing it in a more traditional sense. They're picking, you know, best guys that are left on the board, but their valuations of these guys are not the best. So you're getting the Carlos Cortez's in the fourth round and the, you know, things of that nature, and the Matt Whitakers and the Quinn Brody's in the third round and fifth round, you know.
Man, I really thought Quinn Brody was something.
I mean, he's a decent outfielder. He's the kind of guy that could be called up in an emergency situation, since he is in Syracuse. But I mean, like you were saying, this is why the system is so. You literally have you can go back six years, and it's just out of hundreds of players selected, you're getting like maybe three or four guys. Not a good success.
It's bad.
Yeah.
Now, I think their draft habits have changed a bit, and I have more hope about their more recent classes, but, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, 2022, this past draft was pretty good.
It's very odd, right? Because there are good drafting teams, there are bad drafting teams, and then there's the Mets, who for the past decade, under a variety of different GMs, president of baseball ops, scouting director, Tommy Tan has been there for a while, I guess, but like consistently hit on their first round picks. Like, I don't think there's any arguing that the Mets have had really successful draft picks in the first round going back a decade. Like, Dominic Smith and Gavin Zucchini are not great examples, but you have Nimmo, Beatty, the Rocker debacle was obviously just that, a debacle. Conforto in there. I should have pulled up the entire list before I started on this diatribe, because now I'm running out of...
Justin Dunn was drafted, and
I mean, just does not a Anthony bad Kay, first, just does not still, a bad first round pick. Anthony right, Kay was like a underslot guy, so
they still
and like it. Dom even had a few seasons where he was a legitimately good major league hitter. Like, it's not like he's I don't think he's good, but
he was useful
to the Mets for a while.
Yeah.
The Mets have had one of the more mediocre scouting and development pipelines for a decade, and the Yankees have had one of the best. And the Mets have had vastly more success in the first round than the Yankees, which is kind of my point, right? Like, the Mets do a awful have again, I think it's gotten better in recent years, and we'll need more years to actually fully evaluate this. But for years, they've hit on these first round picks, had generally decent process, Anthony Kay selection aside. And
it's still good process.
And I don't know that Anthony Kay was good process, but we don't need to rehash this argument. And then just like say, all right, we're done. Time to just draft random college performers for the next four rounds. Like, what? And unsurprisingly, that hasn't gone so well. It's a good thing. It's sure it's a good thing they've hit on their first round picks, because otherwise there'd be nothing.
Mm-hmm. So there's Rhett Beatty, we really need you to come through now. You have the weight of the entire 2019 draft class on your shoulders, man. All right, so this week we are, believe it or not, but we are wrapping up our top 2023 prospect countdown. We reviewed 10-6 last week. So this week we've reached the top five, and we're going to be reviewing the top five, the five best prospects in the system. So last week, the first half of the top 10 was Dominic Hamill, Ronnie Mauricio, Mark Vientos, Alexander Ramirez, and Blade Tidwell. And finishing up now, the front half of the top 10, starting with number five, is shortstop Jet Williams. And
Steve, you and I are about to have an argument, I think.
Are we? Okay.
I think so.
Well, I mean, Jet Williams is recently drafted. He does not have too much of a organized professional baseball history here. He only played in 10 games with the FCL Mets, so stats are kind of irrelevant. And the thing about him is he's a short guy with surprisingly big pop, decent hit tool, and really the only major questions are where he'll play. He has really good speed, so he's going to be up the middle, but we're not really sure right now if he's going to stick at shortstop or kind of be moved to center field, because he was playing with an injured shoulder for big chunks of 2021 and 2022. So scouts and evaluators didn't really get a good read on how strong his arm is and how accurate it is. So, I mean, if he comes to camp, you know, this upcoming season and the shoulder is all good and the arm is really strong, he's a shortstop. If the arm is kind of, I mean, I'm sure they're going to keep him at short regardless, but down the road, they might say, we might want to transition him to center field. But either way, those are two good homes for a guy like him. Very high, high on the defensive spectrum. So why are we going to have now a fight about Jet Williams?
Because I think we were talking about this a little bit off air, that you had him a good deal lower than. Well, maybe this is a talk for after we go through the whole top five, but at the risk of spoiling everything else, I think you had Williams a bit lower than I would have him here.
I had him ranked 8.
Yeah, that's...
For disclosure, I had him ranked 8, you had him ranked 4, Ken had him ranked 5, and Thomas had him ranked 5.
To me, and we'll talk about the guys ahead of him in a moment, but to me, Williams is pretty clearly the third best guy in the system. Fourth best guy in the system, counting the late addition to the list. At 2.
I mean, on pure stuff, I think he is one of the most exciting, definitely. But at this point in time, we have no inkling whatsoever if he can handle a decent curveball or changeup, you know? So any guys that are extremely young or don't have much experience are automatically getting pinged in my book because you don't know. You know, he has a shit ton more tools offensively and defensively than, say, Mark Vientos, who I ranked higher. Mm-hmm. But Mark Vientos has dominated guys in AA and AAA. We know his strengths and we know his weaknesses, obviously, but we know that he has major league utility. Jet Williams, not so sure.
I mean, I guess, in a season, sure. No, you go ahead.
I was saying, a year from now, I could very easily see myself ranking Jet Williams number one prospect overall in the system. If he, let's say he plays the year he starts, let's say, in single A and splits the year between St. Lucie and Brooklyn and ends the year in Brooklyn, I could 100% say to myself, okay, you know what? He's shown that he's able to hit advanced velocity. He could show that he can, if he does, obviously, he could show that he can have competitive at-bats against pitchers who are able to hit their spots and throw, you know, rudimentary curveballs and change-ups and everything like that at a professional level. But until we have more data like that, I'm always going to be more cautious about the rawer prospects.
I guess I understand that, but my counterpoint would be that guys like Vientos, even if we know they have some amount of major league utility. Like, there's certainly more certainty. That major league utility isn't particularly hard to recapitulate from another source, which is to say, like, I can find a right-hand hitting corner bat with contact questions pretty much at will in the free agent market, right? Like, probably go to the MLB, like, at this point in the offseason, go find three of those guys who are still on the MLB trade rumors free agent list and sign them for no money. And even if, I mean, you're right that Williams has a much higher probability of, like, never being a major leaguer than Mark Vientos, given that Mark Vientos is already a major leaguer. But he also still has a realistic, I don't think there's a realistic shot that Vientos gets to, like, above average regular.
Hold on, hold on. So you're saying that Mark Vientos does not equal Pete Alonso?
Correct. Shockingly, I don't think that's a fair comparison. Huh. No, I wonder why people got that notion. Truly one of the stranger tweets.
Just, it's so good. It's just the perfect.
It's tweet. Like, okay.
Everything about it's so funny.
It's not even just a tweet.
It'd be one thing if he was like, if the person who tweeted it had been responsible for drafting Vientos, but he's not even standing for one of his guys.
He may or may not be his representation.
He might be his agent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because Vientos is Rock Nation now.
Yep.
Oh, that's true.
Yep.
You know, God bless. I wish we could all be so optimistic about anything.
That's why I love it so much. It's hilarious. Like, he's talking about home runs per at bats and it's a wonderful tweet about a guy who is probably someone who you represent and you use the work for the team that he plays for. It's just, it's so good.
But yeah, Lucas, I hear what you're saying, and it just comes down to, I think, just a slight difference. First of all, the difference in this kind of list between, you know, is very minute. Like, I remember in the comments, people are arguing about like 7 and 8. Like, oh, guys, come on. I mean, it's not, you know, I agree. Everything you said, I agree with. It's just, you know, a slight difference in philosophy.
Sure. I mean, I'll reiterate to close this point that I am extremely high on Mark Vientos. Oh, my God. Yes, Mark Vientos.
You heard it here first.
Yes, extremely high on Mark Vientos, who I just said is a platoon bat with contact questions. No, extremely high on Jet Williams. Very excited to see what he does next year. I think the Mets made a really intelligent choice here, and hopefully it pans out for them.
Yep, agreed.
Yeah, I like Williams more after he got to the system than I did before. I kind of was like, where's the power going to come from? But he hits the ball hard. So it's more like, I think Jarrett said it when I was on their draft podcast, on For All You Kids Out There draft podcast, but he's a short guy, but he's not a small guy. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good descriptor of him. Because he's short. Like, it just is what it is. And hitters aren't normally that short, but he doesn't play that short because he's stronger than that. And of course he's going to need to fill out a little more, and he's never going to be a 40 home run guy anyway. Like, that's just not realistic, but that doesn't mean he's not going to be good.
And home runs are not the end all be all.
And if he could play center and he could run, then you're looking at it.
Yeah, I'm not too concerned. Like, I don't know. I have no idea whether he's a shortstop long term. but with his athleticism, I'd be pretty surprised, barring like a lot of injuries that slow him down or something, if he couldn't hack it in center field. And at that point, I don't really care if you've moved from a shortstop.
Yeah, no, moving from shortstop to center field, it's like, oh no, whoa.
We'll survive. Like, if you're, if he's a speedy plus defender in center with what I think he can do with the bat and like the amateur. And look, I have to be honest, right? Like, I don't have access to the amateur Statcast data, right? I don't have a source that's giving me that. But if it is as good as you hear whispered about, right? Like, if I had the data and it says what people suggest it says, then I would be running this guy up this high up the list. And because that's the kind of shit I really care about, and I trust the people that I've heard say this stuff. So
yep.
That's why I have him so high in particular.
All right, so Jet Williams was the Mets' first round pick in the past draft, but the Mets had two first round picks, and Jet Williams was their second of those. Their first round pick is the next guy that's on our list, coming in at number four, is catcher Kevin Parada. So same thing like Jet Williams, you know, there isn't a lot of, you know, he only played in 13 games this year as a professional in the JCL. I keep doing that. With the FCL Mets and then with St. Lucie. So the numbers don't really mean too much. He does have, though, plenty of there's plenty of data in his college career. He was drafted out of Georgia Tech. You know, catchers from Georgia Tech, there's some good vibes there. But in his two seasons that he had at Georgia Tech, 2021 and then this past season, 2022, he appeared in 112 games there. And he's a 341, 420, 636 hitter. So with 35 home runs total, 9 in his first year and then 26 this past season. He struck out 73 times and walked 47 times. So he is a, would Keith call him a professional hitter? I think he would.
Probably. But he might strike out a little bit too much for Keith.
Yeah, that is true.
But then who doesn't in modern baseball for Keith?
Oh, God, everyone does.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, Parada was considered, you know, by many sources, not just like at the beginning, you know, like in January and February, like just as the NCAA season is starting, all the different scouting evaluation services and publications and stuff will put out their top draft prospects list. And the names that you see in January or February are oftentimes not the same names that you'll see in like June when the season is over and stuff has happened. Parada was seen by some sources as like a top prospect, you know, a top five prospect early in the season, and he was still considered that at the end of the college season. And in probably, like, I don't think that's the right word to say, but just stuff happened. Other teams had other players that they're interested in for different reasons, and Parada fell, and then he fell, and then he fell a little bit more, and he was available when the Mets picked, and we were very happy for that.
Yeah, this is a coup.
Yeah,
that they managed to get him where they did.
I'm also happy that they just ran to the draft board pretty much and took him instead of overthinking, because they could have overthought it because he was falling. But nope, get the good guy in your system. Who cares if he's a catcher? He's probably athletic enough to play other positions. If the absolute best outcome is Alvarez is sticking behind the plate and Parada is a good catcher too, you know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm. I know that's another situation. It's like, oh no, what are we gonna do?
Whatever, man. There's a DH.
Yeah, no.
Parada is athletic. If he could probably play the outfield in some capacity. And if you have two really good catchers and one has to DH sometimes, cry me a river.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah. I mean, he is a very advanced bat. So, I mean, I could see him possibly getting major league at bats next year. Like, he definitely has that Conforto kind of feel about him, that he's going to be in the system real quick, in and out.
I wonder if him being a catcher stops that, just because it's
hard. That would be my only...
To do all that. Unless they, like, switch him off of catcher if they really think that, and Alvarez is working, but I don't think they'd do that, or should do that.
Yes, so, I mean, as good as a hitter is, he is not that good of a catcher. Let me rephrase that. He is a very good catcher. He's a very good hitter. He is not as good a catcher. He's kind of fringy. But there's room to improve. It's not like he's just really fat and slow or anything like that. It just, you know, lack of experience and such. The arm strength and accuracy are the two biggest things that are issues. He only threw out 19 batters out of the 93 that attempted to run on him when he was at Georgia Tech. So, you know, definitely could improve there. But in terms of like, right, mobility, you know, he moves well behind the plate. He's a good receiver and he has a good sense of the strike zone, which is, I guess, the best thing that you want from a catcher. So.
Yeah, I mean, he's they're very lucky to have gotten him. He was arguably, I think you could make a case that he was the best hitter in college baseball last year, and certainly one of the best.
Yeah.
People might argue for Brooks Lee or even Jacob Berry, who I think is a much worse major league prospect, but was a very good college player. This is also not to defend the Mets got very lucky here, right? They really dropped the ball with the whole Kumar Rocker thing, and we don't need to go through the details of that again. But they wound up with a prospect that's, I think, much better than Kumar Rocker at this point. And, you know, they got lucky.
I mean, I think the part where they got lucky, though, was, well, not really lucky, but they messed up irregardless of this. Because
100%, yes.
Because, like, they should have had the backup guy. That's my issue.
Yep.
Like, my issue with Rocker isn't not signing the first round pick, but we've talked about that a million times now. Anyway, Parada was such a good prospect, I didn't even consider him in our way too early draft prediction because I was like, he'll never be there.
I think I
was like stumping for Williams at 11, who they wound up taking
at 14.
Yeah. I forgot it was 14 or 15. I think I was off Porter by the time the draft came around. Anyway, I don't remember. I don't remember 5 minutes ago, frankly. So,
well, suffice to say, we were all very pleasantly happy when he was drafted, and we are all pleasantly happy about his progress so far, and we are watching his career with great interest.
That's not ominous at all.
All right, next up. Is someone that we were talking about before, as he has the weight of the entire 2019 draft on his shoulders, is Brett Beatty. Not going to go too much into the past about him because, you know, he's been a top prospect for a couple of years now. This past season, he played in AA and AAA, and then, of course, he also got a very brief cup of coffee with the Mets. But that unfortunately came to a premature ending because he hurt his hand. But in 95 games in the minor leagues, he hit 315, 410, 533 with 19 homers. I think so. 19 home runs sounds good.
I think that's good.
Yeah. 19 homers, 2 stolen bases to add to good measure. And 49 strikeouts to 49 walks to 104 strikeouts.
49 strikeouts to 100 walks.
Hell yeah.
Then he's gone from like the 15th best prospect in baseball to Juan Soto incarnate.
That's when Keith finally approves.
Yeah. That will get the Keith of approval. If Keith is even on the broadcast next year.
Oh God, don't even say it. But basically, coming to the season, our main bones of contention with Brett Beatty, and I guess that's even putting it kind of strongly, because I'm pretty sure that we had Brett Beatty as, like, the third best prospect last year as well. But we want to see more home runs. You know, he is a guy that has plus raw power. He's a third baseman, so power is going to have to be part of his game. he's a third baseman and also quote left fielder, but power is something that's supposed to be part of his game. And in 2021 with Brooklyn and Binghamton, he hit 12 home runs, which, you know, 12 home runs in 91 games, not terrible, but not optimal either. You definitely want to see more power out of him, and he did respond this past season hitting 19 in 95 games. So I'm basically in the same amount of games, he added almost 10 more homers. And the thing was that he was hitting the ball a lot on the ground in 2021. And this past season, he corrected that. Do I have the data here in front of me? It would be a useful thing to have.
Steve and I are very prepared for the diatribes we want to embark on, you know?
I do have the data, but I feel like just reciting numbers is not very helpful. You know, I could say, yes, he pulled the ball at a 40.3% rate. He went back to the middle, 26.6% rate. He went to the opposite field, 33.1.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to the prior year, and then just announce these numbers over again. But anyone who's interested can go look at his those numbers on Fangraphs. But, you know, basically, Beatty's always kind of, I don't want to say resisted the idea that he's like a slugger because he likes hitting for high average. But, you know, when you're not, I don't know, he just hit the ball on the, too many balls were hit on the ground, especially kind of like weak tappers. And that was a problem. And he adjusted this past season. He was hitting the ball in the air a lot more. And when you hit the ball in the air, when you have his kind of power, you hit more home runs. He hit 15% fewer ground balls and hit 10% more line drives and fly balls this past season as opposed to 2021. So
it was an improvement.
Yeah, I mean, he did all the things that I want personally myself anyway, the things that I wanted to see him improve on, he did. So
great. Do you have any concern? And I'm not saying I do, but I'm posing the question. He certainly made these improvements in AA, and we didn't have enough AAA time to draw any conclusions before he got called up. But he did seem to slip back into the old habits a little bit in the majors. Does that make you concerned at all?
No, because I feel like your initial call-up is a special period of time, and I'm going to overlook a lot of your, you know, if you get into some bad habits, I'm willing to overlook them. As long as those bad habits don't become trends in the long term. And I'm willing to say, okay, this cup of coffee was short enough that, you know, maybe he's starstruck and nervous and the adrenaline and, you know, adjusting now to major league pitching and you getting called up in, when was it, late August or early September, whenever it was. I don't want to say it was a playoff race, but yep. It kind of was.
I mean, his first game was in Atlanta.
Yeah, like, it doesn't get more serious than that.
So, you know, I'm willing to overlook whatever negatives, you know, in his, what was it, like 6 games, 10 games?
He played like a couple weeks, didn't he? Am I misremembering?
Let me look, because I have him right here. He played 11 games.
Okay, it was only 11. I thought it was more than that. But
he was up for a long, he didn't play in every game, I don't think.
Yeah, yeah.
Buck probably just kept trying to put Escobar back in.
I mean, Escobar started to hit, too.
Yeah,
so
yeah, we had the fall of Escobar.
Yeah, that was like right when Escobar started to heat back up. So it was a little bit of a weird thing, I think. But honestly, the thing I was worried about more was his defense. It looked so bad when he was doing whatever he was trying to do at third base in the majors last year.
Supposedly, he spent the offseason working with Troy Tulowitzki, of all people.
Yeah, right. I was like, okay.
Because when I think of a third baseman, I think Troy Tulowitzki.
He was a good shortstop. So.
Troy was a very good shortstop, especially given his size. And Beatty is a tall, large person. Like, he's not heavy, but he is large, right? Like,
he's a big guy.
There's something to be learned there. I don't know.
And I mean, Troy Tulowitzki probably knows how to play third base.
I'm going to assume that Tulowitzki has some wisdom to impart. Yes.
It was just funny. It was like a Mad Libs, like remembering a guy almost, because we're that old now where guys I remember is their primes are now helping some 21-year-old play third base.
Would you rather have Troy Tulowitzki help him play third base, or would you rather have Brandon Inge help him play third base?
Brandon Inge could teach him how to be a super utility player.
Yeah, Brandon Inge, I only remembered Brandon Inge because going all the way back to this discussion, because one year in one of my very early fantasy leagues, he was catcher eligible as a third baseman. And
nice.
Just a super broken mechanic. I'm like, oh, I have an actual hitter at a catcher? Great.
That's when I used to roster Isaiah Kiner-Falefa at catcher, because Yahoo took forever to take him off, and I would just get like 20 steals from catcher and win steals every week.
Nice. Yeah, Beatty's defense, he's a big dude. He's not very, like, quick twitch muscly, so he just kind of has, like, slow and stiff actions. I wouldn't say he's a bad defender. He's the kind of guy that's going to be, like, always, I think, net negative, slight net negative to about scratch average, and that's, like, the best you'll get. And then, you know, maybe 10 years from now when he's starting to actually legit get old as a baseball player, then he'll be quite possibly bad defensively. But he's, you know, his value is always going to be like Vientos. His value is always going to be with the bat, but he does give you some defensive value at third base.
Oh, yeah, he's a better defender than Vientos, who I don't think.
I think, like, I think he can get to average. I'm not saying he will get to average, but I think he can.
But even if he's a below average third baseman, right, like, you don't, he's going to have Lindor next to him, and right, that'll help. And if your worst defender is your third baseman, like, Escobar was the Mets' worst defender last year, and he was, it's fine. Like, there's a few times I'm like, oh, Jesus. But for the most part, it was fine. And he's
right, he's on average, he's not going to make you go, oh, Jesus, very constantly, you know.
And if he does, there's a DH, and it's not like not the best that's not the best outcome. Like, I would very much like Beatty to stick at third, because that handles that, and then you could use DH for a Vogelback type, or if Alvarez doesn't stick, there's other things you need out of your DH. If unless you just want to load manage it, you could do that too. But
I don't think that there's any question that he stays at the at third base. I think that there's a kind of, what's a good way of putting it? Same thing, similar. We'll talk about him in a little bit, but similar kind of with Alvarez. I think that there's a kind of, I don't really know how to put this, like, this a kind of notion that you must have excess value at whatever you're doing. And I think that Beatty is a good enough third baseman, and I think that's good enough, if that makes sense.
Look, so if you're saying, like, go ahead, Thomas.
Go ahead, Luke. Oh, because I was just going to say, like, you could be a below average third baseman and still be a way positive player.
Right, so it doesn't matter. Exactly, yeah.
If he fixes the launch angle and pull side issues, which he seems to have been at the very least making progress on already, and he just needs to translate it to the majors. And like we discussed, I agree with Steve that I think he'll fix it in the majors. Like, his batted ball data is such that he could be one of the better hitters in baseball.
Yeah, I mean, he's top, not just top,
like, his exit velocities are stupid. He makes a good amount of contact. Yep, he has good plate discipline. Yeah. It has every ingredient you want for a, maybe the right word is to, like, there's a chance in an elite hitter here. All the ingredients are there. He just needs to stop giving what the pitcher gives him, for lack of a better term, and realize that he's a big honking boy with a lot of power, and swing the fucking bat and hit the ball 450 feet. Like, you can do it. You don't need to hit a line drive into the left center field gap. Just pull the fucking ball, please.
Yeah, like we're talking very highly of him, and he's just not a top Mets prospect. He's one of the top prospects in the sport. Like Alvarez, of course, is, we'll talk about him, but he's a better prospect nationally, but Beatty's top 20, top 15. You know what I mean? It's not like he's the Mets' third prospect, but he's the 150th best. Like, he's a top prospect in the league. Like, the ceiling is enormous and it's worth discussing. It's, his defense is not going to hold him back unless he's J.D. Davis out there, but even so, you'll deal with
him. He was already better than J.D. Davis.
Of course, yeah, exactly. Like, I'm not, like, I was just, I, that's the first name I thought of to be, like, a really putrid defender, but I don't know. Like, I don't think his defense will ever be bad enough where it adversely affects his spot in the lineup, because I think the bat has the potential to just outweigh it.
Agreed, yep. All right, now coming in at number two on our list is a quote-unquote prospect, and is not Nick Morabito.
Shocking. I was convinced it was Nick Morabito.
No. It is none other than the Mets. Would you say that he is the biggest free agent that the Mets signed this winter?
No, it's Verlander. No,
Verlander.
He might have, right. Senga might
well, it's Carlos have, Correa, but.
Well, yeah. Justin Verlander is a first ballot, maybe even inner circle Hall of Famer. No doubt.
If you want to argue that Senga has the most long-term implications for the club, I could agree with that. But if you just want
not even famous. I think maybe most exciting is probably the best.
I think he's second.
I would agree with you that he's most exciting.
Yeah, like I feel like just the signing of Verlander combined with DeGrom leaving and everything like that, it kind of casts like a weird shadow on everything. It's like, oh, okay, well, we're swapping one ace out for another. Like, cool.
This is what you're supposed to do. Yeah.
Right. With Senga, it's like, not that it came out of left field, but, you know, it is not something that we're used to the Mets doing. And it generated a lot of kind of goodwill and excitement. And it's like, oh, shit. Like, awesome.
I mean, how many times did we talk about it on here?
Many.
Like, I feel like once a month when we would do the KBO and MPB updates, we're like, wow. I wonder when the Mets are going to sign one of these. And look, here we are.
Yeah, so Kodai Senga, a very exciting free agent at the Mets signed in mid-December. He's a veteran of Japan for 11 seasons. So, I mean, I'm not going to go over every single season. For his career, though, he has a cumulative 2.59 ERA. In almost 1,100 innings, he's allowed 800 hits. He's walked 414, which is a 3.4 walk per nine. And he struck out 1,252, which is a 10.3. The last couple of years, you know, kind of more important. In 2021, he had a 2.67 ERA in 111.1 innings. And then this past season, he had a 1.89 ERA in 148 innings. That 1 year, 2021, he kind of was sidelined by some injury, which is why so few innings. He only made 18 starts, as opposed to in the low to mid-20s or so, which is kind of normal in Japan. But I don't know. It's kind of weird. Like, I really don't know where to start here because we're just going over this guy's entire career. But I guess the stuff, he has a good fastball. He has an elite fastball for Japan. And I would say that it would be an elite fastball in the U.S. as well. It sits last year. It was averaging 96, which is good by any measure. And it sometimes topped out in the high 90s. And even hundreds. Complementing it is a sinker, a pretty solid sinker, a changeup, and then a forkball, the ghost fork. And also has a slider, curveball, cutter. I mean, he's very Yu Darvishian in that he could throw a lot of stuff.
But can he throw left-handed?
He probably can. I should say he definitely can, but he can't on a competitive level. I mean, I could throw left-handed. I could throw right-handed. I'm right-hander, but can I throw competitively? No. So, I mean, focus on the fastball and the forkball. The fastball, like we said, it is an elite pitch. The forkball, also an elite pitch. Last season, pretty much half of all of Senga's strikeouts came on that one pitch. Statistically, it was the most difficult pitch to hit in all of NPB last year. It had a whiff rate over 50%, a chase rate of 40%.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, yes, he was pitching, you know, like he did have a statistically outlier year or whatever you want to say, but it is a good pitch. You know, it is his bread and butter pitch.
I mean, it's you could see it when you see video of it.
Yeah.
Like, obviously, it's not going to do that in the majors, but it's going to mess some guys up for sure. Mm-hmm. It just falls out of nowhere.
And it's, you know, it's a pitch you don't really see too much in major leagues. You know, a forkball is just kind of a more extreme splitter. And even splitters, you know, you don't really see too many guys throwing them. When Masahiro Tanaka came to the U.S., you know, he was able to have a lot of success with his splitter that he brought over from Japan. So I see no reason to think that Senga won't be able to as well.
Mm-hmm.
Really, the only two things that I'm concerned about with Senga are his command and his health. Even in Japan, he was not the most accurate guy in his career. He only had a season where he had a first pitch strike rate over 50% once in his entire career. So, you know, that isn't the end all be all, because you still obviously have more pitches to work with and at bats, but he is not a pinpoint thrower, and that definitely might come back to bite him in the ass in the MLB, especially where you have hitters that are able to do more stuff that, you know, is not as good. Or could wait him out, or can foul things off, or, you know, et cetera.
I will also admit, and this might even be more concerning for me than the control, which I don't disagree is at least a semi-notable concern. I don't love his fastball shape. I don't think it's particularly, I don't think it'd be very analytically friendly either. And I know he's had success with it, but I wonder if that's just sort of a function of having very good velocity for Japanese baseball. I'm not saying it's a disaster, but I worry that it may even have some negative synergy with the control, right? If he has a not great fastball shape and he can't locate it particularly well, it may get hit harder than you expect, even if his splitter is a disgusting pitch, and I do think that's going to translate, but I'm a little, call it some mild concern about the fastball shape.
It gets hit a lot more than you would think a high 90s fastball should get hit.
It's almost Syndergaard-esque, almost. Like, he feels like you might have one of these guys who every once in a while pops off this, like, 13-strikeout outing or whatever, and you're like, wow, that was incredible. Why isn't he like that all the time? And is somewhat enigmatic and maybe frustrating in that respect, but for the money they're paying him and the potential of, like, there is a potential he's just, it does all translate. They tweak his fastball shape a little bit and he comes out and is like an ace. Like, that's within the realm of possibility here.
Yeah, the range of outcomes are pretty wide. Best case scenario is he legit couldn't be an ace pitcher or pitch like an ace pitcher, you know. Worst case scenario, he sucks completely, but most useful worst case scenario is he's kind of a reliever-ish pitcher, where just maximizes the fastball on the splitter and does nothing else, which is
Uji Uehara-esque.
Yeah, with a much better fastball.
Yes.
Which is not a bad outcome per se, but it's not what we're expecting him to do.
No, you'd want more than that, ideally.
Yeah.
Koji Uehara was a really good closer for a couple years.
Yeah, he was. Can't complain. Baltimore got some good years out of him.
So did Boston. He was on their World Series winning team, wasn't he?
That's who I think, yeah.
Who am I thinking of?
He was also with the Orioles. You're right.
Okay. I was about to say.
They traded him to Boston for nothing particularly special, I don't think.
He's going to be one of the guys who, I don't care about spring training, really, because I just, after like a week, I'm like, okay, where's the games that count? But when he pitches, I'll be like, ooh, that's exciting. Let's see what he does.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to watch.
Yep. Just to see it in a Mets uniform, to see what, I've seen video of him, but it's different when you see it in a game setting and you're watching him in and out of each at bat and seeing how he gets into trouble and out of trouble. All that stuff is way more interesting than just highlights and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Also, shouldn't he be just the number one prospect? Like, if we're really going to do this?
If we're going to be honest, yes, but...
He's the number one prospect in baseball because he played professional.
Yeah, and, I mean,
I'd still take Gunnar Henderson over him, but yes.
You know what I mean, though? Like, yes. Like, then he's two or something. Like, because I think Gunnar Henderson is a good shout. Like, I would take Henderson, too. But,
That's like, your point, though, yes.
He's a five-time... champion in another league,
exactly.
And he was the ace pitcher on the five-time champion team.
That's his top prospect to me.
Like, that's better than Alvarez hitting bombs in Binghamton.
I mean, realistically, that actually does have some kind of major implications, because if Kodai Senga was classified as a prospect by more outlets, the Mets would possibly gain if he won, you know, Cy Young Awards, Rookie of the Year Awards, all those kinds of things. But since he's not classified as a prospect by most of those publications, the Mets are actually losing out. So it's like kind of funny, like, joke about, but in reality, like, that actually could have, like, that could actually be, like, a major deal. But it is what it is, you know.
I mean, he is, right? He could win Rookie of the Year.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think think they get a draft pick?
No, they don't, because
there's like a carve out for professional.
He's only on, I think, MLB.com's list,
right?
Or Baseball America's list, someone's list.
I think he's on Baseball America's list,
but he's like, not on, like, baseball.
He's not on BP.
Right, he's not on BP, he's not on MLB.com, he's not on Fangraphs, he's not on, you know, the other lists, if there are any other lists that they are looking at. So they lose the possible rewards of calling up a rookie and having that rookie excel throughout the course of the season, which kind of sucks, but it is what it is. And then also to quickly just kind of touch, you know, don't want to spend too much on Senga, but his health is kind of dodgy over the course of his career in Japan. He, you know, he has 10 years basically of wear and tear in his arm. He has also dealt with a lot of like minor issues, more so than a lot of other pitchers there, in addition to that 10-year career. So I don't know. Over or under 110 innings?
Over.
Probably. I think his health stuff would be later in his career.
It is, and Steve raises a good point. The Mets also did add some injury language to his contract, which was in the news recently.
Heyman had it, right? They were worried about his medicals.
Yep. I mean, nothing disastrous, obviously, because the deal wasn't altered that much, but it's notable. And they've certainly done a better job of building depth than they have in years past. So you can survive him hitting the shelf for a little bit, but maybe this discussion would be better summarized by he's a pitcher. Yep.
Yeah. He's a 10-year veteran rookie. You know how that goes.
Yeah.
I'm sure every single 24-year-old in the minors has arm stuff too, if you look deep enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Exactly. All right. And now the number one prospect in the system. Again,
Nick Morbido. It's Morbin time.
Francisco Alvarez.
Thank you for my first recap when he does well, Lucas.
Mm-hmm.
My first title.
Yeah. Alvarez also, like Brett Beatty, he got a very brief cup of coffee in the majors, and I'm not going to include that. So this past season, he played 112 games at AA and AAA, and he hit 260, 347, 511. With 27 home runs, 70 walks, and 123 strikeouts. The results are very stark and very different between his time in Binghamton and his time in Syracuse. In Binghamton, he played 67 games and he hit 277, 368, 533. In Syracuse, he played in 45 games, so about the same, and he hit 234, 382, 443. So the batting average took a pretty big hit, and the power output did as well. But he was playing hurt, it turns out. He was playing there for about a month or so, and then he got put on the disabled list with some loose bodies in his ankle?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So you can definitely say, okay, the guy was playing hurt for most of his time there, and he still had a 825 OPS. That's, you know, that's fine.
And didn't he start really slow and was, like, getting BAPIP or something, if I'm remembering correctly? And then
he did heat up, yes.
Yeah. And then he started heating up anyway, and it kind of fixed the line a little bit.
Especially the last week or so when he came back from the injury, he was, like, really good.
Which probably leads into he was playing hurt.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I mean, Alvarez is, you know, the number one prospect in the Mets system, and you can make the case that he is the number one prospect in all of baseball, and if you don't accept that, he's still
2-3
within, like, the top five, you know, and that's being very, very generous, you know. He is a top prospect in baseball. I mean, he is really... nothing that he does that you don't like. You know, he hits the ball very hard. And when I say very hard, I mean very hard. Just, and it's a kind of swing.
Hard.
Yeah, and it's a swing where you don't say, like, oh, God, this is stiff and he's going to get eaten up against, you know, better velocity or really good curveballs, you know, really good breaking balls. You know, it is a strong that it's a swing that is strong and can hit pretty much anything. His defense now, like, similar to what we were talking about with Brett Beatty, his defense is, it has all the ingredients to be a kind of, you know, slightly negative to average. But as a catcher, that, you know, that kind of gets magnified when you're a catcher. And the thing that he does, the aspect of catching that he's weakest at is kind of most magnified right now. He's like a not good framer, and that's kind of is in vogue right now. That might be completely mitigated in a year or two if they adopt, you know, the robo umps and all that, you know, and framing is a thing of the past. His arm is decent enough to be catcher. He moves well enough behind the plate. You know, I've always been more high on his defense than other people. And again, I think it comes with the mentality that I don't think that he needs to be perfect. I think he has, you know, he could just be good enough. And I think his defense can be good enough that you deal with it. And even dealing with it, I think, is maybe a little extreme. You just go with it.
Yeah.
It's not Ryan Dumit back there.
Yeah, that's literally the name I thought of.
I feel like he's the guy everyone comes up with for a really terrible defender or catcher.
Like, I don't think he's that bad. I don't think he's good. I think he's stiff, and I don't like his movements back there much. But also, he's a bigger guy, and it's hard. It's a physically tolling position. I don't blame him for it. It's hard. I did it for a long time at a much lower level. I was just a travel guy around Brooklyn. But, like, I don't love his catching, but I don't think it'll matter if he hits because so few catchers hit that you will just deal with it, I'm pretty sure.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, how many games, let's see, how many games did Tomas Nido play? Tomas Nido played this past season in 98 games, and he had exactly 600 OPS. Now, I mean...
it's the opposite problem.
Yeah. The Mets kind of had a weird situation because, you know, they kind of had to play, what's his name? I don't remember
McCann.
His name anymore. McCann, thank you. He got traded. Who cares about him anymore? But, yeah, they kind of had to play McCann. They kind of had to just see, like, okay, maybe he had one bad year. Is this guy really actually that terrible? So, yeah, I'm not going to say they kind of had
like, yes.
Yes, he was, unfortunately. You know, it wasn't like a true platoon between Nido and McCann, but they both kind of got into a lot of games. But I mean, if the Mets are willing to play have Nido play 98 games and have a 600 OPS, and that's kind of like, well, that's the best we can do. You know, Alvarez does not have a very high bar that he needs to pass.
No.
No, and it's like there's way you could coach him up for it to be a little to be passable, and then it's fine. Because really, how many catchers have both in the league right now?
Adley Rutschman and maybe Will Smith.
Right.
He's not even a great defender.
He's good enough. Like he's a good enough defender. And Alvarez doesn't have to be a superstar back there. He just has to be fine. And if he's fine back there and hits, then none of us will care about this. The pitchers will care, I'm sure. But they can get over it.
Yeah, you could imagine like DeGrom chewing him out or just like giving him or death Scherzer. Glares. Yeah. I feel like Scherzer would be more the guy, kind of guy to yell at him on game day and then get over it the next day. And then DeGrom would just hate him forever.
Yeah, DeGrom would go into Buck's office like, hey, Nito's catching when I pitch.
Yep.
DeGrom would just be sore because Alvarez hit a home run off of him in like spring training last year, and it was a mammoth home run.
Yeah.
That is the kind of power that Alvarez has. It's when he can hit mammoth home runs off of Jacob DeGrom. Even if it's rusty spring training Jacob DeGrom, it's still DeGrom.
Correct.
Oh, like Alvarez's potential to be an offensive weapon behind the plate is insane. Like,
yeah.
The likes of, I mean, I don't want to say Mike Piazza because that's the first guy I thought of with the bat, with the Mets had, but he wasn't a great defender, and the Mets dealt with that shit for a long time, and it didn't matter. And not saying he's going to be a Hall of Fame level hitter, but if you hit and you're a good enough framer, no one will care. We'll get over it real quick.
You heard it here first. Francisco Alvarez is Mike Piazza.
Lock it in.
Well, let's see. Mike Piazza, when did he break into the league? He broke into as a 23-year-old. And he only hit one home run in his rookie year. So Alvarez is already outpacing him.
You heard it here first, folks. Francisco Alvarez better than Mike Piazza.
If these trends continue.
Yeah.
But the thing is now, in Mike Piazza's second year, he hit 318, 370, 561 with 35 home runs.
Jesus. Is that all?
Jesus Christ.
And 46 walks to 86 strikeouts in 149 games. So I feel like that is a steep hill.
So that's the bar, right?
Yeah. I mean, I could see Alvarez hitting 35 home runs.
I don't know about the rest of it, but
I don't know about 318.
He's not going to get enough play. The Mets aren't going to give him enough playing time to hit 35 home runs, I don't think.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like he's going to break. Unless something crazy happens because of Narvaez.
It just means that he will have to hit two home runs a game.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's easy solution, duh.
Mm-hmm. Just hit more home runs. Duh. Why didn't I think of that?
So when do you think it comes up? Because I don't really know.
I am very perplexed.
Yeah.
And I wrote about this in the like grading article for the Narvaez signing, which I think is actually good value. I like Omar Narvaez. I think he's a good player. I think he's a fine starting catcher given his defense. And there's some offensive upside given his past performance. And I still gave the signing a C because what the fuck are you doing with Francisco Alvarez here? I don't get it.
Was he signed to a 1-year deal or a 2-year deal?
One with an option.
Okay. I mean, is it possible that...
And they extended Nito for two. Right.
I mean, I guess it really depends on how hot of a start Alvarez gets off to, because you could trade, you know, teams will always be looking for catching. I mean, you could always trade Alvarez, even if you're getting back pennies on the dollar, just because you need to get Alvarez in the lineup now. I don't know.
Sure.
He's kind of like a hedge. You know, if Alvarez does good and gets off to the start that you want to see, then you can say, okay, goodbye, Alvarez. But if he doesn't, then you have, okay, we have a decent everyday kind of catcher with us, and potentially next year too as a hedge in case.
But like Alvarez needs to be, I don't say needs to, like I don't mind him starting in AAA so he could just catch five times a week or whatever and really
right exactly
work on that part of his game. But
that's why I'm not in up in arms that he's most like 95% not starting the year at the major league level, because it's his defense that needs the more reps, not the bat.
But even when you call him up, like you can't. there's no one to, you're going to carry three catchers and then it's a weird roster.
You're
going to
carry three catchers and a DH only player.
Right. Because Vogelback and the way the roster sets up, like Alvarez would have to catch against the lefties and then like DH against the righties. But that's what Vogelback's for. You know what I mean? Like it gets, it starts to get real weird how you fit all those players into the roster at the same time in July. And of course, now we're talking 10 steps ahead and someone could get hurt. Someone
These are all good questions to have because
you're not wrong.
I'd much rather be wondering how we're going to get Francisco Alvarez's bat, you know, in the lineup than saying to myself, oh, you know, Brad Emaus is starting again. Oh, well.
Man, I thought Emaus was Emaus, whatever. I liked that. I was like, oh, this will be fun. And then it wasn't.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's not a good problem to have. It's just.
Yeah.
I feel like we were going to have these questions in July or June or whenever Alvarez is very clearly done with AAA, because I think that's what's going to happen. And Beatty's a different story with no Correa now happening. Beatty's just going to come up either going to break camp with the team or come up pretty quick because he'll force his way up, but there'll be a roster spot for him. There'll be a place there. And Alvarez, I think even if he starts destroying the ball, I could see the Mets being conservative and that being a thing that we talk about while he's hitting over 300 in AAA. Everyone's like, where is he? I'm like, well, where do you want to put him? Like, yeah. There's no place for him in the roster. And that's kind of weird that they did that to themselves.
And I'm assuming it's not a service time manipulation thing because this Mets group has been not inclined to service time hard manipulate, and also you get a draft pick now if things go really well.
No, I legitimately think they think Narvaez is good, and they think that Alvarez needs more time on his defense. And I don't think those things are necessary. I'm not a huge fan of Narvaez, not as much as you are, Lucas, but he's fine. Like you could, if you platoon him and Nito, it's a good defensive tandem, and he's a better hitter than Nito, so sure. And Alvarez does need the work defensively. It's just, it'll cause, I don't want to say problems, but it'll be an interesting roster fit in July. And of course, Vogelback could pull his hamstring and be out for 6 weeks, and then we don't have to worry about
it. Could actually put him on the DL or IL this time, instead of
exactly, instead of making him play hurt like they did last year. But that's also another thing where catchers get hurt. Nito could take a foul ball off the hand and break it, and here we are. None of this is a problem. So,
It's a fair point.
Well, I mean, it'll be exciting to see what they do. It'll be fun because it's a good situation. It's the Mets actually have some decent players coming up now, and it's exciting at really kind of important positions.
The two positions they needed the most in this entire offseason.
Which I believe you wrote about, right, Thomas?
I did, because I did when I thought they were not going to sign someone else, and then the Correa stuff happens, but
yes. Well,
very lucky, I guess, that they were two clear ways to upgrade the roster, the offense, with a third baseman and a catcher, and that is their first and second prospects in the, by far, if you don't count Senga. Like, it's not even a competition.
I mean, it's almost, look, I'm not going to say that the roster would be better with Carlos Correa on it. There's no, at least for the next year, there's no denying that. I don't know what the long-term medicals imply. But, and I think this is the point you made in your article earlier in the offseason, like, they have two weak spots on the roster, and they have top prospects to fill them. And this offseason, they made sure they had serviceable guys at those. Like, Eduardo Escobar is a serviceable third baseman.
Yeah.
Narvaez and Nito is a serviceable catching platoon. And so if Beatty doesn't work this season or Alvarez doesn't work this season, you're not screwed. But you've also left yourself room to call them up and be like, hell yeah, this is great.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's basically the crux of it, because if you have to go an entire season with Eduardo Escobar, the Mets won 100 games with that last year.
Yep.
And by default, Narvaez is going to be better than McCann.
Like, you're not starting Brian Anderson or something. Brian, I like Brian Anderson, but there's good contenders should probably not be starting Brian Anderson, right? Like,
agreed. Like, the Brewers are being weird, and that's why they're starting Brian Anderson. And like Eduardo Escobar, if he's your worst hitter, he's like league average. And if he's worse than that, and if Beatty isn't working, then you just make a trade for a third baseman who will, or an infielder who will be available, and you could figure it out.
Yeah, it's kind of an advantageous position to be in.
It's also it's a little lucky.
Yeah, God knows with the rest of the NL East, they're going to need to be they're going to need to have a lot of options if things go bad.
Yeah, I mean, I think they have the best roster in the division, but it's not so huge a gap that things couldn't still go wrong and things don't go their way. And having this sort of a contingency slash succession plan set up is a good thing.
I like that. A succession plan. Nice.
Mm-hmm.
And then that helps future off seasons when, if it does work and your catcher and your third baseman are sorted for the next 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, then you can pay Shohei Ohtani $50 million a year because you're paying your starting third baseman and catcher $800,000. It's perfect. Yep.
And then you could do the Braves extensions if you want to. You could get a little creative with it all.
Sounds like a plan to me.
The Mets, and last thing before I let Steve kick us off here, like the Mets should be trying to extend both these guys right now, I think. You don't need to be exploitative, but like you don't need to give them laughable contracts or manipulate their service time if they don't sign. But I think it's worth putting it on the table and say, hey, do you want the Luis Robert contract? We'll give you that. Both of them are worth the downside risk there. Now, I don't know that the Mets will do that. They've shown no proclivities towards that sort of deal, but I hope it's something they're thinking about at least.
All right. Well, if anyone has any questions, comments, whatever, you can shoot us an email at our email address from complextoqueens@gmail.com. You could follow us on Twitter and shoot us questions there. I'm at Steve Sipa. Lucas is at ElVlahos343. Ken is at Ken1191. And Thomas is at SaidMetSeasonSZN. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcast from. Rate and review it. And we thank you for listening. And we definitely do thank you for listening, everybody that does listen, because we know that you're out there.
Mm-hmm. It's great when we get comments on Twitter and like, please engage with us. Tell me that you disagree with me about Ronnie Mauricio. I'll tell you that you're wrong, but you know, we can have a good discussion about it.
As long as you're arguing in good faith and not just blatantly saying you're an edgelord and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll be back next week. We'll probably have some interesting news to share with everyone next week. But until then, love the Mets. Love the Mets.